Previously on From Python Import Podcast.
Oh, come on. Really? No, 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 no. Do something new this time.
Code Monkey, get up, get coffee. Code Monkey, go to job. Code Monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say Code Monkey very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant. What do Code Monkey think?
Hello and welcome to From Python Import Podcast. My name is Mike Piernot, and with me tonight is...
Hi everybody! My name is Dave Noyes.
Welcome, Dave. I also want to give a shout out to Ben Smith, who can't join us tonight because he is out of town and helping to take care of his dad, go through some issues with the hospital and health situation. We love you, Ben, and we miss you, and hope everything's going okay for you and your dad. Everybody out there in Python land, give them some good mojo, some good thoughts. So tonight we have a very special, fun interview lined up. I think it's going to be pretty exciting with the one, the only, the real Katie Cunningham to talk about Young Coders Tutorial, her new book, and all kinds of other exciting stuff. And there might even be baked goods. But first, I just wanted to get through a few sort of recent news sort of items and things that are out and exciting and interesting. Django 1.6 is out, actually Django 1.6.1, which now supports Python 3, yay, officially. So everybody out there who is working on projects that are built on top of Django and you haven't ported your stuff to Python 3 yet, now is your time. Go out there and be a rock star instead of a poopy pants. Port your stuff. Some other things that are in there, better transaction management, simplified default templates for your apps and your projects. Admin is turned on by default, about time, in my opinion. Clickjacking protection is on by default, probably a good idea. This kind of blew me away, persistent database connections. Like, did you have any idea, Dave, that they didn't have that?
I had no idea. And tell me this, why do I care?
Well, if you have a persistent database connection, you don't have to clobber your database opening and closing connections all the live long day. You can establish a connection and then reuse that connection between your app and your database to get lots of data moved across without having all that expensive setup and teardown and stuff and that makes your database sad.
Less clobbering, more data.
Yeah. As well as better test discovery, which everybody likes. As well as bug fixes and security improvements and all kinds of good stuff. And I just saw this week that the Django blog is doing their periodic update posts, so they're going to be telling you every couple of weeks or every week. I'm not sure what cadence they're going to be on, but they're going to be telling us about the new cool stuff that's happening all the time.
Nice. I always like when someone else does the work for me, so that's
good.
Yeah,
absolutely. Another thing that's kind of cool that has happened recently is Python 3.4 has its first beta out, and there's a lot of new cool exciting stuff in that. There's async IO, which is a new experimental API for doing asynchronous IO stuff. Mm-hmm. There's support for enumeration classes with enum. So if you ever wanted to do an enum in Python, now you've got that coming to you. Bundling of pip is coming with ensure pip. Pathlib is coming, so you can muck around with file system paths, OO style.
How's that different than path, which already exists, right?
Right, but I think that path is not in the standard library, and this is new stuff that's in the standard library.
Gotcha.
There's a statistics library that's coming to do statistics, and a whole lot of more really cool stuff. So if you want to see awesome, hot, new Python stuff, go check out the beta of Python 3.4, test it out. Make sure it runs good on all the platforms you care about, because nobody wants to be surprised later with bugs. We've got to find that stuff early.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of conference announcements. PyCon US, I feel weird calling it US because it's going to be in Canada this year, but PyCon is coming up. That is in April this year, April 9th to the 17th of 2014. And that is in Montreal, Canada. So for everyone who's in the United States and is used to getting off really easy traveling to PyCon, make sure you get your passport. Get your passport, get your passport, get your passport. Get it early. It can take longer than you think.
That is a good pro tip right there.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't want to not go to PyCon because you were like too late submitting that passport application. It can take a while. This is government bureaucracy at its finest, and sometimes it does not give you that passport as fast as you want. So go get that. And of course, you can find out more about PyCon at us.pycon.org. And I am super excited to announce that I am going to be giving a tutorial again this year with Dave Stanek, who's one of our other hosts.
Yay!
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about the OWASP Top 10 Web Application Vulnerabilities. We're going to do a hands-on, pretending to be bad guys, learning how to attack a little toy website, and understand sort of the most common forms of attack, and then how to prevent against them. So
nice.
That's kind of a fun time. Yeah, one of the most gratifying things about that class was when we ran it at PyCon last year, we had someone who went to lunch and fixed a production security bug that they had like within that hour because they had just learned things at our tutorial. So that was really cool.
Oh, wow.
And really special. So it should be fun again. If you can't wait for PyCon in April, you can get your fix in February at Py Tennessee. That's February 22nd and 23rd of 2014 for their first annual Py Tennessee conference. The schedule looks really awesome. I'm really excited for these guys. I don't know if I can make it to this or not. I hope somebody from our group can, because it looks like it's going to be a great time. So you can check them out at pytennessee.org. That's pytennessee.org, which is a whole lot of letters, but it's going to be fine. We'll put it in the show notes. It'll be great. Something I'm probably not going to be able to go to that I'm really kind of sad about is DjangoCon EU. Did you hear about this, Dave?
I did not. Please tell me about it.
So last year, I think they were in a circus tent. This year, their venue, they've rented a private island in the south of France.
So is this reflected in the price of the conference?
It didn't look like it, but I didn't look too closely at it because it's the kind of thing that work is never going to send me to.
Right.
But if you are in a position to be able to be in the south of France in May, it is May 12th to the 17th, 2014, and you can find out a lot more about it at djangocon.eu. It looks like a really great time. The last year's looked awesome, too. I just never can get across, and I don't have the budget to do it on my own. So
we'll show those French. We'll have it at Put-in Bay.
Oh, now watch as everyone Googles for Put-in Bay. We should throw that in the show notes so that like anyone will possibly get that reference.
You're welcome, everyone.
Hey, it's okay. It's got the fourth tallest monument in the United States there. Did you know that?
Are you serious?
Yeah, at its construction, the Oliver Hazard Perry Monument was second only to the Washington Monument.
Are you sure you're not lying? Like, that's a true statement?
That is a true statement.
That makes sense. There's a lot of steps in that thing.
Yeah, there is a serious...
It'll be fun. Let's take the steps.
There is a serious big-ass monument out on this little island in Lake Erie.
By the way, it is not fun climbing the steps, no matter what anybody says.
It is
not. It's kind of stupid.
But the view is great, I'm sure. And then the one other thing I wanted to give a shout-out to, one of the places that I go to find my news lately, and one of the reasons that, honestly, we didn't do the podcast for like a year, is PyCoders Weekly puts together a great weekly digest of all the awesome things that are going on, linking to announcements, new packages, blog posts, articles, all kinds of great stuff. You can find out about them at PyCoders.com, or you can follow them on Twitter at PyCoders. And they are a fantastic source for this stuff, and they can keep up with it a lot faster than we can.
This last article, I actually bookmarked a couple about unit testing.
Yeah, there's some great stuff in there.
Which look pretty promising. And my favorite part is they have pretty much nonsensical, unrelated, humorous subject lines for each newsletter.
Yeah, so every Friday you get a new one of these, and it's always a delight. So go check them out. PyCoders Weekly at PyCoders.com. All right, so enough of all that nonsense. Now for something completely different. Our interview with the illustrious Katie Cunningham. She is a Python and Django developer. She is an author and a speaker at conferences. You may have heard her on the show in the past, so friend of the show, Katie Cunningham. And you can find out all about her at her website, therealkatie.net. And Dave, you had a question about that.
Yeah, okay, so I was going to go with a really corny joke based on that, but I'll ask this instead. How do we know you are the real Katie?
It is actually on my birth certificate. I'm not Catherine or Caitlin or, you know, Kathy or anything that. I'm actually named Katie, and I'm the only Katie I've ever met. I've met people, I'm like, oh, your name's Katie. Is your name really Katie? And they're like, no, I'm actually Catherine. The story is, in high school, when I was in one of my classes, it was my senior English class. It was a class with 28 students and 5 Katies. It was one of those names that was just really popular in my, like, generation. So, unfortunately, there was already a Katie C. So the other Katie C, since she was there first, they called her Katie C, and they tried to figure out what to call me. And I said, well, my name's really Katie. All you all are pretenders. And so they decided to call me the real Katie. And years later, I would tell this story, you know, occasionally. I knew I had to create a website for myself because I was starting to build a presence, and I was like, what am I gonna call it? It was the worst like week. I was like, I don't know what to call it. And one of my friends is like, well, that story with the real Katie stuff, use that, just call it the real Katie. And it was available, so I grabbed the real Katie, and that's what it's been ever since.
Right on. So you're not totally full of yourself. There's an actual story to go with it.
There's an actual story. And I'm still looking for another actual Katie, but I haven't run into one yet. They're all named something else. So
fascinating. So you're like the real Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Of Katies.
There is actually, the bizarre thing is, there's another Katie Cunningham in the Python community. And I almost got all her, I almost got all her stuff canceled last PyCon.
Oh, no.
Because somebody emailed me and said, did you mean to register for all this stuff twice? And I said, oh, no. I am infamous for registering for stuff, forgetting, and then going back and re-registering. And I was like, oh, no. I didn't mean to register for any of that. So fortunately, they looked at the email, and they're like, we doubt she would have used a separate email. So they contacted her, and they're like, you're not Katie Cunningham at NASA and Cox Media Group, right? No. We're going to have to get you guys to meet up at some point. But it was funny. I almost had all of her stuff canceled, and I felt horrible because I didn't even think about it.
Oh, no. This is why
overloading
is bad.
So she actually calls her, yeah, on Twitter. However, she's exclamation point Katie Cunningham, so not Katie Cunningham. Not Katie Cunningham.
That's excellent. All right, so speaking of PyCon, something that you've been up to a lot lately that I see is this Young Coders tutorial. I hear good things about it, but I am not a young coder, so we would like to know more.
Speak for yourself, okay. Buddy.
I got all this gray hair, man. I'm old.
I dye mine. So, Young Coders is a tutorial. It's an all-day event. It's supposed to be an 8-hour from like 9 o'clock, time their butts hit the seats, and we release them around 4 or 5 o'clock. So they've got a full day. And what we do is we sit them down and we go over how to program in Python, and it's geared toward kids between 12 and 18. And it starts off very simple. It starts off with, this is a variable. This is how you store stuff in a variable. This is an algorithm. We actually go over, like, we use a peanut butter and, like, how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And we have a loaf of bread all wrapped up and some peanut butter and some jelly and all the implements we would need. And then we have the kids tell us how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Now, I usually teach this with Barbara Charette. I have taught it on my own as well. And we both, like, will go off and do our own thing. But it's funny to watch the kids, like, at first, they're like, oh, put the peanut butter on the sandwich. So you take the jar of peanut butter and put it on the loaf and step back. And they're like, no, open the loaf. And so you, like, you know, and it's funny to watch the kids get it, that they're like, oh, okay, and that's how you teach algorithms. And it takes a very scary word, which was honestly a word, even after I had been developing for a while, I was still scared of that word. Sure. Because I think the reason was I first encountered it in math class, and it was a lot scarier there. But it's like, no, it's just instructions. That's it. That's all, you know. So we would go through, and they would, you know, we would eventually make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, which was great because it also doubled as snack later. So the kids could go back and make sandwiches. But so it's an all-day thing, and we actually get up to just shy of object-oriented programming.
Oh, wow.
And it depends on the class. Some classes, we cannot hit that. The one class I had, we had two classes at PyCon. The second class, we got through it. We actually were able to explain, this is what an object is. You know how we've done functions and we've done, like, we've grouped things together? This is just grouping functions and variables together into one package and copying them over. And they're like, oh, okay. And they just got it. The thing that you spend, like, 2 weeks on in computer science, like 101, mm-hmm. They're like, well, of course, that makes sense. And it was just, they totally got it. We actually have all the stuff on all of our materials on GitHub.
Oh, that's handy.
So we encourage people. We're like, fork it, branch it. You know, we've had people send back stuff to us. When I was at PyOhio doing this, my shadow, who is this great guy, sat there and made a cheat sheet in the back of the room. Because usually when I teach this thing in a non-local location, I will request the conference to get me a shadow. So somebody to watch and observe how I do this, okay. So they can do it in the future.
Oh, great.
Because as much as I love traveling for this, it's always been a struggle to pay my way. I don't ask you to pay for my hours, but I ask you to pay for my hotel and flight, you know, so sure. I don't have to drop $1,000 to get out there. My accountant really does not like that.
Yeah, out of the goodness right. of your heart.
Exactly. And they can usually cover that, but I'm like, it's a lot easier on you people if you can get somebody that's local to do these more often.
Right. Well, it scales better, right?
It does. I've lost track of how many classes we've done at this point. We're doing this again at 2014, and this year, I believe, I'll have to double check with Jesse, but I believe the classes will be bilingual. We'll have an English cool. class and a French class.
Wow.
Ooh. I think, I hope, that's one thing we discussed. We have a teacher all lined up, and we're excited about it. Now it's actually going to come down to, like, space. Mm-hmm. We're running them during the conference, so it's not being run during tutorials, which, oddly enough, works really well, because you can get more volunteers to come and help out. We try to keep the ratio of 3 children to 1 adult in the classroom.
Okay.
So you have, including the teacher, because things go wrong. We usually teach these on Raspberry Pis, and Raspberry Pis are awesome. They're robust, but because they have so little memory, they're also easy to accidentally break and lock up.
Sure.
So you've got to restart, and restarting them is super easy. Unplug them, plug them back in, sign them back in. It's not that difficult. Mm-hmm. But in the middle of the class, you can't have the teacher stopping and fixing that one kid who keeps trying to print out "Hello World" 5,000 times.
Right.
which will like crash a Raspberry Pi.
While true, print Timmy is awesome.
Exactly. So let's see. You know, but it's a really great course. At the end of the course, because it is make games with Python. We take the games from Invent with Python that are already loaded onto the Raspberry Pis, and we actually let the kids play them during breaks. I tell the volunteers that come, I'm like, you will see the kids playing with the games. Don't stop them. Let them play. And you know, some of them, it's like, no, no, and I'm like, no, no, it's okay. It's let them play, because at the end of the class, I'm like, let's edit the games. What do you want to change? And it's like, oh, let's change this. What do you think we should look for? Well, look for a variable called apple. Okay, let's look for a variable called apple, because you want to change how many apples there are, and or size, or things like that. And it's really amazing to watch us, you know, watch everybody, like, change the games and, like, make them harder or faster, and then I flail, and because I'm horrible at these games, and I'm like, ah! No, it's, but that's how we end the class, is basically an hour of edit the games or, you know, free code, and that's when we really need the volunteers, because that's when volunteers will often sit down with the students and help them write something that's interesting to them.
Sure.
I was curious, Katie, what are some of the more interesting things you've seen the kids do on their own? Is there anything that has maybe kind of stood out that has impressed you the most?
The cutest one I saw, it was hilarious. Kate made a text Minecraft.
You might want to say that again. I think Hangout is killing us right now.
Like a text adventure game, but Minecraft. Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm actually watching my ping. Okay, ping's back. The cutest thing I saw was a kid made a text adventure Minecraft.
Oh, wow.
Oh, cool.
And I was just like, I'm like, this is horrible. It's like, this is so, and he did where he was like, build house, and it's like, there is a house here now, and, you know, there's a skeleton, kill skeleton, and, you know, it was a very linear game, but it was Minecraft in a text adventure format. Another young girl took, she wanted to do a lyric quiz game. And I said, we had gone over dictionaries. I said, well, we're dictionaries. Let's use dictionaries. And so she took like a song title and paired it with a lyric and then created, like, got all the values, mm-hmm. picked four random ones, mixed them up, and then had it where you could pick, like, you know, which, you know, song it was from. And she was like super excited that she did it. It was simple. It wasn't that many lines of code, but it did what she wanted. And she was really excited and already thinking of, like, new things she could do.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And is that kind of one of the things that keeps you going, seeing the excitement and wonder from the kids?
That and the excitement and wonder from the adults.
Oh, yeah.
It's hilarious watching, because, I mean, I'm at the back of the room, and the door is almost always at the other end of the room, just because I need the projector. The way that the rooms are always set up. And people will come by and look in and just have this big, goofy smile. They're like, oh, my God, and they'll take pictures and just get really excited about the fact that the kids are there.
Is really cool.
It is. And, I mean, during PyCon 2013, I kept trying to emphasize to the kids, I was like, you are the light of this conference. You are the thing everybody has been most excited about. And it was, well, besides the free Raspberry Pis, but that was the thing everybody, like, was talking about after it happened, and they were just so excited and so thrilled and so, like, you know, it was kind of breathtaking, and they didn't, like, it's a free class. I'm like, you don't understand. You're our future. You know, you mean something to us.
And you know, kind of on that note, what actually got you started with this? And were you really expecting anything to come from it?
It's actually kind of hilarious. Jesse Noller came up with the idea, I think. It started somewhere in that area, and he went to Lynn Root. And somehow between the two of them, the idea was started, and she was going to run it. Around that time, she got her crazy busy job at Red Hat, I think, somewhere big, where she was, like, traveling all the time. And she went to him, and she's like, look, I'm going to need someone to help. And he's like, well, Katie, you help. And he's like, you know, you have kids, and the thing is, I was one of actually the few people in the community that had a child around the right age, which was kind of, everybody else has young children. I have a 12-year-old, almost 13-year-old, so I had, like, the perfect demographic living with me. So he's like, you two know each other, and you two figure it out. Well, then Lynn got super busy, and Lynn's like, I have to hand it over to you. And I'm like, crap. Barbara, would you like to do this with me? And Barbara was the one that ended up, we did it together. She actually took her slides, Barbara Charette's slides, that she would use to teach adults. Uh-huh. And she used them for Pie Ladies classes. And with very few changes, the only changes we made after we ran the first class, shorter variable names. Which longer variable names are fine for adults because adults type quickly. Yeah. Children do not.
Right.
So we made them shorter. And that helped out. But a lot of it, it's the same material.
Now, that's interesting because I was curious, what have you seen that's different about how kids learn this material versus how adults do? And are there things that maybe surprised you and maybe that they do better than adults?
I found that the limiting thing, because I get people all the time that say, hey, I would really like to sign up my kid for this class, but they're not 12. And I really kind of hold hard to the 12. I make exceptions for extremely exceptional cases. Mm. And the reason is typing speed.
Mm.
And that is the number one limiter for kids. If they cannot type quickly, they cannot learn quickly in these classes. It's kind of bizarre because the way they learn, like an adult, if the adults are learning, they're watching and they're kind of taking it in, and then we pause and then they do the stuff. Kids, if you put code on the screen, they will type it into their computer and they will run it right away. And that's how they learn, is they type it in. And if it doesn't work, they just erase it all, type it in again, and erase it, type it in, and they'll just keep doing it until it works. And then they'll make minor modifications. Adults tend to want to understand the theory behind it, and the kids are fine with, like, just show me the mechanics, and I will get the theory later. That's the biggest difference. And that's one of the reasons why I tell people it does not matter. And this one guy cornered me, and he's like, hey, I'd really like to get my daughter into this class. She's really mature for her age. I'm thinking the kid's 11 or 10. I said, well, how old's your daughter? 6. Dude.
Wow. Nice.
6 is not appropriate for this class. There are other materials that you could totally put in front of your daughter that she could enjoy.
Right.
But 12 is the hard limit. And also, there's kind of a babyish, there is definitely a line with children, the elementary age and then the middle school age, that you get the young kids. And also this guy, I said, and he's like, but she's really mature and smart. And I said, dude, I have never had anybody come to me and say, my kid is stupid and immature, but could you take them anyway?
That's amazing.
I'm like, all the kids are smart and mature. It's like, they really aren't. When you've ever worked in education, most kids are perfectly average. You know, they're fine.
It's like Lake Wobegon, right? The children are above average and everyone's good looking.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. And I'm like, dude, really, I cannot take your daughter.
By the way, Mike, I can't believe you pulled out a Lake Wobegon reference.
I'm sorry.
It worked for me.
I'm a product of my upbringing, which involves a lot of PBS and NPR.
Yeah.
And one other thing I was thinking about, or was curious about, once kids start to learn to code, do you see their mindset changing at all? Does it help them in other areas, do you think, by knowing how to code?
Demystifying the computer helps quite a bit.
Yeah,
I don't
definitely have
long-term experience watching this, like, over time. I mean, sure. I get a day with these kids. Mm-hmm. But I do know a lot of kids will tend to, when I've watched them, will start to apply the principles of what they learn in a class when they do programming to other areas of their life, like problem solving. There's definitely, you cannot program without the ability to break apart a problem and think about its parts. Mm-hmm. And that's a really important life skill. And that's definitely something that's, it's hard to teach. You know, my son has Asperger's, so I had to teach this to him, to break apart small problem, to break apart big problems into the small problems. I had assumed for a long time, oh, this is an Asperger's thing, so we have to teach this. And one of his middle school teachers laughed. He's like, could you come in and teach all the neurotypical kids? Because that would be great. And he's like, that's not an Asperger's thing. That's a normal kid thing. And I'm like, well, when you have the Asperger's one first, your scale for normality goes way out of whack.
Oh, I bet.
But, you know, I had to teach him to do that. And it's really hard to, like, teach that as a skill. But because you have to be able to do it with programming, all of a sudden you can say, I'm going to break down this problem. Even something as simple as how do you Google? Because do you know a single programmer who can survive without Google? You learn to Google really quickly. You learn how to search. You learn how to find good resources. And I've discovered when I've had to research other things, my skills searching, which were honed in order to program. That's really the only place I really learned how to really fine-tune searches and dig deep instead of just clicking on the next pages until I lost my mind. And turning those skills over and looking at other things, whether it be researching travel options or, you know, stuff like that, that's where I learned those skills, was when I was just starting out programming.
I gotta say, that's really cool because at least when I was in school, I hated school. I never found anything that I was learning to be interesting, so I didn't care. And I can tell you now, if I was able to mess around with games, something fun, and learning without even knowing I was learning, that could have helped me out a heck of a lot at an early age.
Or at least, you know, a project where it would be more interesting. You know, I've heard of kids that, you know, are into programming, and they've done stuff like, okay, well, I have to do this thing for history class. Can I make a website? Can I make a simulation? Can I make, you know, I do this thing for science? And I hear about at my son's school, and they're like, you know, if they know how to program, they will try to bring it into the classroom. And they will try to say, can I do this thing? And it helps renew their interest. It also, it can shorten the cycle, the learning cycle. So you're able to learn, basically, how quickly you can fail determines how quickly you can learn.
Nice.
So, you know, trying to explain to somebody a mathematical concept and saying, here's this mathematical concept. Stats is actually a really great example. When my old stats teacher was always amazed at how far we could get. He had been teaching since the 70s. And he said, in the 70s, I could barely get through a quarter of the book we have now. And then these great things called TI-83s came out, and all the kids had them. And all of a sudden we had computers, and you could enter in this data and just download it. And he said, what has amazed me is now we can get through basically what would have taken me 4 years of courses in one semester. Wow. We got through the book in the first half of the year. The second half of the year was just us running experiments and fine-tuning our skills.
That's really cool.
He's like, this is what technology, because he said the amount of times you can fail all of a sudden went up, that in order to figure out the average, you didn't have to sit there and add everything and then divide. You put it in, you checked it, you know, you put it in again, you checked it, you know, you could compare things, you know, where did things go wrong? He's like, but I can have you compute 60 different averages in one class period if I wanted. He's like, that would have been a week's worth of work, you know, before to add up all these things. And the fact that we could download data sets to our calculator, and he would give us the assignment, And then he'd sit back, knowing the assignment only took 10 minutes, but we had 20. And he said half the students kept their TI-83s out and started doing other things with the data set. And going, did you know that there's two outliers, and if you remove those, the mean actually goes over to here, and that's a significant difference by this amount. Because wow. I was the nerd. I love school. But he's like, that's what he noticed. And programming is a way to make it so you can fail more often, and you can fail quickly, and you can go back and say, no, that was wrong. I mean, that's why one of my biggest, somebody was asking me, she's like, how do you debug code that's not throwing an error? I'm like, just start breaking shit.
Yep.
Just go in, print statements ever. I'm like, there are better ways to do this, and I'm sure that other developers have more nuanced ways, and there's PDB, which is great. But first thing I usually do is just start breaking stuff and seeing how it breaks.
Yeah,
and absolutely. Seeing what's printed out. It's like, there you go.
Yeah, my philosophy for any kind of
PDP's
production or weird debugging kind of situation is I go into what I explain to my managers as Dr. House mode, where I have to do several wrong things that are going to bring the patient near to death, but then we'll figure out what it is.
Drop it!
Oh.
Dang it, I thought I had it on mute. Damn it, I was doing so good.
That would be Louie, the dog. Hi, Louie.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That'll be great. We'll fix it in post, right, Dave?
Yeah. By the way, what I was going to say is I have a friend who's a teacher, and he is very behind the use of technology in teaching. And he knows a lot of teachers that kind of fear it because they're thinking, oh, no, this is going to replace us. And he's like, no, really, it's not. It is a tool. And it's gonna help the kids learn faster and in new and different ways. It's gonna get you to what you care about faster.
Mm-hmm.
You get to cut out some of the tedium and the busy work, and you're actually gonna teach.
Right,
and that's that
self-learning and experimentation seems to be really where the sort of like holy grail is of learning and education.
Yeah, definitely. So I don't know. It'll be hopefully a lot more teachers embrace this and start to understand it better.
We're trying to get to more teachers. We're definitely trying to get to more teachers. Teachers are very hard to reach because they're busy. They're often overtasked. And it sucks because I went to my son's school and I'm like, look, I have this awesome program and I can do it. I live locally and you already have computers and we could do this for free. We could do this once a month and have a workshop. You know, I could train up your IT guy and we could do it together. We could, you know, do it every other weekend or whatever. And they were so into it. They're like, oh my God, this is awesome. We would love to do this.
Nice.
But they never have time. And they never have time to like, you know, to sit down. And so this summer, finally, it's like, let's talk this summer. And it's like, yes, we will sit down this summer. We will, you know, there'll be no grades to grade. There will be no, like, exams to proctor. We will sit down and we will get this done. So hopefully this summer I will get them more invested in a program like this.
Have you looked into or tried out that Hour of Code? I've been seeing a lot more of that lately.
I wrote something for Hour of Code.
Oh!
What did you write for Hour of Code? I'm so excited.
I wrote an introduction to Python, and oh, they slashed it to death. Oh, my goodness. They took away, like, almost, like, so much of my content.
Aww.
But unfortunately, I mean, hey, I'm like, I don't care. You pay me $200 to write that thing. Fine. Because Pearson will pay you to blog.
Okay.
Which is really nice. But yeah, I basically do an introduction of what is programming. Let me see if I can find it. Pearson Hour of Coding. Please don't mute me. Pearson Hour of Coding. Katie Cunningham. Let's see if my thing pops up.
If you send me the link later, I'll make sure that gets in the show notes correctly also.
Absolutely. Cool. Hello world and Alice. Ah, here we go. The 5-minute Python programming. Oh, they slashed us down so much. It was so sad. because they couldn't. They only waited the 5 minutes, and I'm like, darn it. So I'll put this in the chat. Where's Teddy thing? There it is.
I suppose that means I should probably start the chat thing.
Oh, no, it's going. I see it.
I just didn't have it up. Yeah, sorry. Cool, thank you.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it was way longer. It went over, like, all kinds of stuff with, you know, how to do for loops and math and stuff, and they just kind of went with the very, very short. Oh, no, wait. No, wait. They ended up, when I complained, they put out the rest of it. Oh, cool.
Oh, that's cool.
I went to them, like, where's the rest of it? Okay, if you go to hit the next, they put out the rest of it. So I basically go over in what you what a person can read in a few minutes, what is Python, and at the end, I do a guessing game. So I was very proud of this.
Oh, very cool. Yeah,
so yeah, I wrote for it.
That's outstanding. Yeah, we've been playing a couple of the iPad games with my daughter, who's six. And she, one of them is called Codable, and it has like a little fuzzy creature that you basically give it a sequence of like up, down, left, right directions, and it just rolls until it either hits a wall or you tell it to go some different direction. And we're a couple sections into that, and she's pretty excited about it and has something, you know, programmy to do with me. She's like, Daddy, is this kind of what you do? I'm like, yeah, kind of. Daddy has to stare at a lot of, you know, boring-looking text sometimes, but...
It's like, no, what Daddy does is usually less satisfying and more frustrating.
When I asked my daughter, I was just curious one day, I asked my five-year-old, I said, so what do you think I do for work? She's like, you go to meetings and drink coffee. Like, fair enough. But I showed her my roguelike, a little roguelike I have on Python, which I was doing to learn Pygame. Because I was a part of a Pygame tutorial, which was hilarious because I got accepted for it before I had written one line of Pygame.
That's a great way to motivate yourself to learn.
Yeah, well, fortunately, Richard Jones was doing the heavy lifting on that. I was there to talk theory and design. So, because that at least I had a little bit more, like, I could talk about that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I programmed a little roguelike. So I showed it to her and I said, you know, what do you think? What do you want? She's like, more treasure, obviously.
Yeah.
And I was like, loot. And I'm like, okay, let's make more loot. And we made more loot. And she was really excited. She got that. She's like, you changed over here, and it changed the game. And that she understood, you know, immediately. It was like not even like an aha moment. It's like, well, duh. Of course. That's how you make the computer do different things. I actually have both of them on Ubuntu. Which I fear is turning me into one of those, like, hipster parents. So I'm like, my kids don't have a Windows computer. They have, like, Ubuntu from, you know, this indie developer. You've probably never heard of them. They both have System 76 laptops because I wanted to break the Windows habit. That's really, becomes really strongly ingrained. It's okay for them to learn Windows later. But I think that if they learn on something else first and they're comfortable, like the only way they can start Minecraft is going to their command lines.
Oh, wow.
You know,
nice. It's, I approve.
Yeah, it's great. And so they have to, like, you know, start up Minecraft that way. You know, they get used to that kind of stuff so that later on they're not just like some people I know who have Windows and I'm like, open up your command prompt. And they're like, my what? I don't have one of those.
The cold sweat start.
Yeah, and I'm like, run, start, CMD. Yeah. What is this? And, you know, but they have to know how to do it.
Yeah.
And they're also getting, and one thing I love about what the attitudes they're getting now is that when my son wants something, he'll go onto the Ubuntu, like, little store, and he'll look through, and most of the stuff there is free. So he's getting really used to open source free software solving a lot of his problems. And rather than going and saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to, you know, buy this thing for $50, you know, like he wanted to do some image editing. And I'm like, well, check out GIMP. And he, well, first he's like, I'll Google GIMP. And I'm like, no, no. Well, that's... Having a son who can Google, by the way, how old are your kids?
My daughter is six, going on 17.
Yeah.
Anytime I try to pull bullshit on her, she just looks at me and goes, Daddy.
Yeah. Let me tell you, when your kids start Googling, your entire life changes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because I'm kind of terrified of that.
My son was on a racing game, and he was tweeting back. He was, like, messaging back and forth with me as I was going to a piloting meeting. And, you know, I was just going back and forth, and he's like, I can't, these vans are stupid. And I was like, what? What are you looking for? He says, well, I put in I'm searching for creeper van, but
what?
All that's showing up are these white vans, and I don't get it. They don't have creepers on them. He was looking for Minecraft creepers.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, okay, one, don't Google that. Two, yeah. We'll have to talk about this when I get home. He's like, am I in trouble? I'm like, no, you're not in trouble. We just need to talk about this, why that came up that way. And he was like, all right. And I had to explain to him what a creeper van was when I got home. And I'm like,
that's amazing.
Yeah, oh, you've run into all kinds of weird things.
So, you know, we've talked a bit, you know, about young coders here, and there's been some awesome stuff. But I want to ask, where do you see this going, and where would you like to see it go? Not just with you and your class, but overall.
We would love to see more people teaching this locally and remixing what we have. Ours is meant for an 8-hour Raspberry Pi, everybody in one room session. However, there's been a lot of discussion that, hey, not everybody can do this. So cutting this material up so you could, an after-school club could use it. Mm-hmm. Creating a network of people who know the code, of experts who know the code and know how to talk to kids. Knowing the code is not difficult. Knowing how to deal with kids and their questions, and knowing that sometimes you have to back up and re-explain something.
Sure.
There are many people that, and I got into a couple internet fights. I wrote an article called Teaching, there are actually two, Teaching in Empathy and Learn How to Use Windows, the OS Divide. Which it's like you have to be able to talk to students no matter where they're coming from.
I remember reading that and feeling deeply ashamed because I don't do Windows at home and I barely do Windows at work. And it's definitely a weak spot for me as a speaker and tutorial instructor.
And that is something I recommend everybody go out. You know, it's not expensive to get a Windows laptop, unfortunately. We all know why. but getting one cheap, you know, and just keeping it under your desk if you do run tutorials and making sure your material runs on a Windows machine. When I was writing Teach Yourself Python, I had to break out my Windows machines, both 7 and 8, and install everything and run through the instructions and make sure I understood how to get everything running. Because one of the criticisms of other books that have come before me was that there were no Windows instructions. Mm-hmm. They basically assumed a Mac. And it's like you can't assume people are on a Mac because it's also, and I try to point this out, it's like this is also an economic decision.
Yep.
When people don't have as much money, when I didn't have as much money, I bought Windows laptops. I actually still have not yet, I have yet to buy an Apple laptop. Like a Mac, people buy them for me. Like my companies will say, here is your Mac. I've yet to buy one of my own. I don't really have the desire. I recently bought I'll usually just go out and buy like a Linux laptop. But it's like it's an economic decision because if you can run out and buy a Windows laptop for $400, which you can do, you can totally go out and get that today, you cannot get a Mac for that amount of money.
Right.
I'm on a Windows laptop right now, and I got one for $500 on Overstock few months ago. So I am one of those people. I've had Windows machines since I've been about 15, I think. Mm-hmm. And one nice thing you can do, depending on how motivated you are, you could always get up and running something like Vagrant, for instance, So whenever I feel like it, I can fire up an entire... I have Linux. And whether you want to do it in a VM or with Vagrant, you can do it.
Yeah. And I mean, there are people who are like, well, when I teach a class, I'll just get them started on Vagrant. And I'm like, dude, these are people who figured out where their command prompt was 10 minutes ago.
Very true.
So it's a level. Now, if you have more advanced users, then you can totally, like, if I had somebody who's already, like, you know, a developer who's been on systems, I can be like, I'm going to show you something cool, and we're going to do this. And we're actually doing this at a future Pilates thing where we're going to be going over proper virtualization and setup for locals for our more advanced people that have not really done it yet. They've, you know, kind of doing it, but still being a little lazy. But it's like, no, here's how you can really do it, and it's solid. But beginners... barely understand the idea of a computer within your computer. And they're like, well, why can't I just use my computer? And it's like, well, because the other one works differently and it works better. But my computer works fine. It's really fast.
Right.
Like, yeah, and I mean, and one thing, when you move over, I work on a Vagrant image. Our work, the only way we can keep standardized is to work on Vagrant images. So I use one all day. Mm-hmm. I am really familiar with them. And I'm also familiar with how slow they are when compared to, like, your regular machine. You kind of get used to it. Yeah, you kind of get used to it after a while. But every once in a while, I'll boot it up, and I was demoing something for business. And I'm like, okay, everybody, get a sandwich. This is going to take a few minutes. And, you know, but it... I had forgotten how slow it could be just because I was so used to starting a process, grabbing my knitting, and getting a row done.
Right.
It's like, do-do-do-do-do. It's like, oh, it's done, you know, and going back. Really bad during a demo. So, and people will get frustrated with that if they're used to machines working quickly, and they know their machine can do this quickly.
Sure.
You know, and one of those things I would love, you know, if I'm going to teach somebody to use, like, Linux, I am going to sit them down and start, you know, like, here's how we use it. You know, here's how you get to the command line. Here are the different, because even how to get around, even if they're familiar with Windows, it's completely different, you know.
Right.
And whenever I have to touch a Windows machine, I have to take a moment, like, recenter myself.
Right.
And be like, do not do LS. And it's,
I was the kid in high school who made bat commands so that I could have LS and all the Unix-y things. Yeah, I was that kid.
With my
I kept typing LS at MS-DOS machines, and it drove me crazy.
You know, my second or third year in college, I didn't go in for computer science. I switched to it, and I had a C in Unix course, and I remember I was in the lab, and I had to type LS. I didn't know why, and it frightened me. And then I went into Vim, and I, honest to God, I got the cold sweats.
Oh, no.
I was panicking. I'm like, oh, my God, I broke this. How do I get out? What do I do? And I'm, like, all panicky.
Yeah,
and...
no new person should ever go full Vim. That's never go full VI.
And see, that's where I actually started off. Now, fortunately, my computer science teacher was great, my first one, because she set everybody down. And was like, today we're going, the first 3 weeks of this course is learning how to get into Unix and deal with it and not have a panic attack. So we learned it was great. So she taught us, like, you know, how to get around, how to, you know, SSH in different servers, how, you know, how everything was set up on our local, like, you know, network, where we could go to code, you know, what the different IDEs look like, everything. She gave us, like, before, I mean, we were learning a little bit of coding at the time, but I think we had barely gotten into, like, variables and math in 3 weeks. But then after that, boom, we were off. But she really laid a great foundation. She was like, here is what your environment is. This is the world you're going to be living in for the next 4 years. Ooh. So let's get you very familiar with how it works. And it worked. that once all of us were like settled and really comfortable and could get, you know, get around, then we took off, and then within another 2 or 3 weeks we were doing like object-oriented programming and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But she also had the lowest attrition rate.
Ooh.
She had very, you know, like the class was still full at the end of the semester, which is really not common.
That's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I would expect that to be sort of the washout class.
Yeah, and no, the washout class was, two semesters later when, okay. But this teacher, he was actually wonderful. He was one of my favorite. I learned from both of them how to teach. She taught beginners very well. He taught reality very well. Because when you came in, he's like, you know, you never get 6 weeks to work on a project. You get like 4 days. So everything will be due. I'm going to give it to you, and you have to turn it on the next Tuesday. So basically, he'd give it to you Thursday, and it was due the next Tuesday.
Whoa.
And he's like, so that's pretty much how everything's going to run. Then one time we had a larger project, and he's like, okay, we're going to have checkpoints, everybody. You know, we're going to have 3 checkpoints for this, and I want everybody to be up to this point by the time they come into class. So we came in, and we had our little printout that proved that we had gotten to that point. And he turned around, and he says, you all have your code with you on disk, which is, you know, back in the dark ages. So we all have little disks. He's like, mm-hmm. Put them all up here, put them in the basket, you all pass. You know, he made us trade code. With a stranger.
No.
Awesome.
He's like, finish their project.
Whoa.
And I was like, what? And he's like, you got to learn to read other people's code, and they're not always going to be good.
This guy was good.
He was so great.
He was so good, and he was like, and he was one of, he took me aside, and he's like, you need to be a programmer. He's like, there are people that get into this course. He said, you've been acing everything. And he's like, you complain, but you're doing great.
That's another important skill.
Yeah, and I went up when he, and I was like, he's like, you have to trade with fellow students. I'm like, but my fellow students suck. Like, he's like, I know, but still.
But that's life.
And it was, and I was like, oh my god, but it was really fascinating how he taught, and he taught reality very well, and I think that's kind of how, when I think about how to teach more reality-based courses, which I haven't done any real life, but I'm working on a few, like I'm working on an accessibility real life course, you know, that's how it's like punishment, but it's really how you encounter these things in the wild.
I think I want to incorporate that into my next hiring interviews at work, and you know, like get someone like, you know, here's a piece of code.
Ooh,
fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And by the way, speaking of real life, you have a book coming out.
I have a book that came out.
It came out.
Hey, there you go.
Yep, it came out in October. It's Teach Yourself Python in 24 Hours. It's part of the SAM series by Pearson. And it is. It's actually meant for beginners. It's meant for people that do not know how to code.
Okay.
And it takes them all the way through what is programming, all the way up to dealing with databases. You write an app in Flask. You use Pygame.
Oh.
It teaches you to use Git. And how to properly like search for your problems and use things like Stack Overflow and IRC.
This book sounds great. I might get this.
Please do. I was really excited. I mean, when I first started like writing the outline, because when you do books like this, you have to write an outline first, and that thing gets passed around, and people argue about it. Mm-hmm. And Doug Hellman helped me with my outline, and it was kind of funny because at first I wrote the outline for the first like 2/3 of the book. That was easy, and it's like one concept. You know, I'm going to cover, you know, if statements. I'm going to cover like loops, and I'm going to cover, you know, this easy. And around 2/3 of the way through, I ran out of Python,
mm-hmm.
like pure Python. And I'm like, crap, what do I do now? It's like, okay, well, I could cover databases. Well, that's going to need two chapters, and it ended up being two chapters. Like, I could do other stuff. And actually, I started thinking back to my classes and the adult classes and I thought, what are the questions they always ask me? And one of the questions that always they're like, how do I make a website in Python? And that's a really intimidating question when you think about it. Mm-hmm. And around that time, I had just encountered Flask. Now, I'm a Django developer, so you would think that I'd go like, oh, Hour of Django. And then I remember every time I create a new Django site on my local, I forget how to do media paths. And I have to go to my other projects and go, how the hell did I do this last time? I forget stupid stuff, you know, just because there's some stuff that, you know, it's not intuitive. And it's not for beginners.
Right.
You know, there's a wall you hit. And I had just encountered Flask, and I'm like, I'm going to take a weekend and play around with this. And I created these delightful things in Flask. I'm like, it's pure Python, and you add like four lines to your code, and now you have a web page that's serving your stuff. And oh, it was so cool. I mean, it was actually the first time I had felt delighted with a new thing.
Oh, wow.
And it actually reminded me of how I felt, because I came originally from the Plone world. The first time I touched Django, back when it was like in 0.9, and it felt very light and simple. And Plone, I was on Plone 3 at that point, and that was a very heavy period for Plone.
Yeah.
Plone was becoming Java, and you know, I don't want to insult me, but yeah, it was very quickly becoming Java. It lightened up after that, but I was very sad at that point. And then I did Django, and I'm like, this is like airy and fast and beautiful. And now Django is more complicated.
Right.
And Flask is once again airy and light and beautiful and does just what you need it to do. So I wrote the chapter using Flask, and I'm actually teaching a class on Flask in February that is an HTML and CSS one day and then Flask the next week.
Okay.
And I showed some women I'm doing this for Pilates, and I showed them what a Flask app looks like, and they're like, I can read this. The only thing they didn't know were decorators.
Right.
They didn't understand what decorators were, and they're like, well, what are those? And I said, those are decorators. And here's what these decorators are doing. And I said, these are saying, when they go to this page, run this function. And they're like, oh, well, that makes sense. You know, and they got it immediately.
Right.
And so they're like, okay, all right. Oh, this is cool. And it makes a web page, run it. It's a web page now. So that was one of the things people ask me. The other thing is, you know, I want to make a desktop application or a game. I originally considered doing a thing on Tkinter, and then was talked out of it by saner people than me. They're like, no. You don't want to give beginners. You can give beginners Pygame, because you can create a screen in Pygame and nothing. You know,
right.
you can make things really easily. Tkinter is not always easy to get things like running and looking nice. And I think actually the last chapter I have, the last chapter is called What's Next. And it goes through all of the active projects, not all, but the highlights of like where you can go and help out in the Python community.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Projects you can get into, and it's like, hey, you like web development? We already went over Flask, but maybe you should check out Plone, Django, you know, and I name a few of them. You like game development? Hey, there's this thing called Pi Week, where you can make a game in a week, and it's a contest, where you can go play the other games. I talk about going to conferences and why you should go to a conference and how to get there if you are a student or you're having financial difficulty, and about submitting talks. It's kind of all the things I wish somebody had answered for me when I was getting into programming.
You know, I was about to make the comment that what really sounds great about this is it's not just academic. You're really getting into, this isn't just teach yourself Python. This is more like teach yourself programming, think like a programmer, and going even way further beyond that.
I try to hit on the social aspects.
Yes.
I've long considered the community and the social aspect to be one of the batteries that Python comes with.
Yes.
And it's really great that that's part of learning about Python is emphasizing that social aspect. That's really cool.
Yeah, and that's when I tell people, it's like, look, we are a friendly bunch. My only warning, I did warn people, I was like, in IRC, if you go into the Python channel, people are very busy and they're curt. And I said, they are not mean. More than often, they're not. I said, they're just being very abrupt and curt because they're trying to fix things. I said, if you ever do have a problem, go talk to an op. They have an at symbol by their name, you know, and they can determine if it was just somebody being very curt. It could also be a language barrier. Mm-hmm. Or if somebody needs to have, if a discussion needs to be had. I was like, that's a good place to, but it's still a good place to go if you're really stumped, because you can get paired off. And there is, in theory, a learning Python or a beginner's Python. I mention it in the book. I lurk in there. I'm horrible at Freenode. My company uses IRC because I'm a remote worker.
Right.
So I have to have IRC up, but the problem is if I get too many pings that aren't from work, I start getting very, very distracted. And some of these channels are people like, are you seeing what's going on over in blah channel? And it's like, oh, dude, I got a thing that's due. I can't do controversy right now.
Right.
Although I am in the Pokemon Python channel.
What? Okay. I was going to say, what does that even mean?
PokePython.
Yeah, I'm not cool. I don't know what that means.
Oh, Pokemon! The little monsters you catch.
Oh, so this really is Pokemon. Okay.
Pokemon, yeah. We all play Pokemon.
Okay.
And when the new one came out, we all went to one channel so we could not flood the regular Python channel with us talking about our Bulbasaurs and stuff. And so we went there so we could trade friend codes, we could talk to each other, and so that's probably the only one. I check in with that, and I check in the Pie Ladies channel. I try to not get drawn into the other ones because I will get very distracted at work.
All sorts of things with cats and lasers and animated GIFs, and suddenly your day is gone.
Yes. Yeah. And I get enough lasers, GIFs, and cats from my coworkers.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I may be guilty of that at work lately. I discovered space cat pics on Twitter, and it's just downhill from there for me. So.
Yes.
So I should ask about the book, Python 2 or Python 3?
It is in Python 2. One of the things that I noticed with beginners is they need to search everything. They have a lot of errors. And everything that's out there is in Python 2. There is a massive history in like Stack Overflow. And in order to get just the Python 3 material, you actually need to be somewhat more astute as to what you're Googling. And that's a problem. And a lot of times you'll see people that are trying to get stuff running, and if they're beginners, they're flummoxed. They don't know what to do. In Python 3, it's like, I understand. I mean, I got a 1-star rating on my book. Somebody was really mad over the fact that it was Python 2 and not Python 3. And I'm like, if that is even a problem for you, why are you reading my book? You know?
Right.
I am way beyond your book.
They just want to feel smart.
They did. And they were like, jerk. I wasn't real happy with that. But, you know, and it was the whole, but the problem is that when I was really wrestling with that, one, a lot of the things that I was pointing to, that the really cool projects, not all of them are over to Python 3 yet.
Right.
And they're working on it, but it's going to be a while. And, you know, I can't tell a person that's beginning, oh, go out and get the development version that's out a few versions that has a lot of bugs, because beginners aren't good at bugs. If something doesn't run, they'll often just walk away. and or they'll sit there or they'll feel really defeated, like, I did something wrong. And it's like, no, you aren't wrong. We're wrong. You know, we're doing this wrong. And it's our fault in a lot of ways because, you know, we didn't push harder for whatever reason. You know, I haven't, and I'll be honest, I haven't followed the whole Python 3 versus Python 2, how it got pushed, you know, what the controversies were, the names, all that stuff. I'm sure there's lots of, like, practical and interpersonal reasons as to why it's taken so long.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is, quite frankly, that, you know, Python 2 doesn't suck.
Right, exactly.
I mean, and it's kind of like, you know, I'm not feeling that, because I had to review a course that did Python 3, and I kept coming away with, why is this better? You know, it's not like crazy better. It's not like, you solved all my problems. It's like, oh, you solved a couple minor annoyances except for that freaking print thing.
Right.
Great. Right. That's helpful. Thank you.
Now it has parentheses.
Wow. My world is rocked. You know, and it's kind of just like, I don't know why I care. You know? That's actually the talk I want at PyCon. I know you don't want to move over to 3, but here's really why you should.
I think we're going to try to line something like that up for our next episode.
Yeah, I will totally listen to that. Because, I mean, I would just love to know, on a practical, like, I'm a Scud developer. I come in, I get my ticket, you know, I fix stuff, you know. Why will Python 3 make my life easier moving over to it? Now, when I moved from, like, let's say when I was doing Django, and I upgraded from Django, I think it was 1 point something to, like, 2.5. We did a huge jump. My life got a lot easier because they added things that we had had to kind of put in there ourselves.
Right.
You know, life got easier. And I don't see how this is making my life easier.
Sure. I think
And I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
I just haven't had the really convincing case made to me. Because everybody gets real angry first.
Right. Well, it looks like they're going to, you know, be bundling virtualenv and some of those things. You know, pip is going to be bundled now in the not-too-distant future. I think it may actually even be in the 3.4 beta that came out. So some of those, like, fundamental tools that we've grown to know and love, but are always kind of a pain in the ass to, like, okay, now you got to go get this thing. Well, why didn't it come with that thing?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that stuff is starting to be there, which is good.
Yeah. And honestly, I think that I know we will all eventually move to 3. I think it's just going to take longer because it seems to take us a long time to figure out the carrots.
Right.
Well, and there's proper, like, enticements, because it's like, we're not going to just upgrade just because.
Right, exactly. Well, especially if you're using it for, you know, business and you've got a production environment, you can't risk, hey, we're going to take our developers and go off for 6 months and convert everything to Python 3. Like, no, you need something that's running and stable and that you can, you know, keep using to run your business with.
Yeah. And when I was at NASA, I don't think people understand, like, with the government, how long it takes to update something. We got out one release every 6 weeks, and we were considered the whiz kids.
Wow.
There were people that worked on releases for 2 years.
Oh, man.
Wow. Mind blown.
Yeah. And so it's like, we can't just go to the customer and say, we need to upgrade this. There needs to be something where it's like, because they will, they're very risk averse. Mm-hmm. When we wanted to move from one system to another, they were really risk averse, and we kind of just stealthed it. They wanted to do a redesign of the site, like the front end. They just wanted it to look prettier. Mm-hmm. And we're like, huh, they're giving us 6 weeks to do this? Guys, can we redesign the back end of the site in 6 weeks? Yeah! Let's just do this. I'm not even sure they ever really were aware until it was done that we had moved over to a different, like, a different back end.
You kind of have to take those opportunities when you can find them,
yeah,
too.
And yeah, and those opportunities are rare. We happened to hit the perfect moment when the customer was distracted with all the pretty designs. our manager was distracted dealing with the distracted customer. Nobody was paying attention to us, and we all knew about this one thing that we had just been looking into and we had been practicing. Without all of that being in place at the same time, had we not been ready, we never would have been able to move forward. It wouldn't have happened. And there was never another... I've worked at NASA for 5 years. There was never another opportunity like that.
Oh, wow.
That was the one time we got to throw something in really fast. Every other time, we had to justify everything.
Wow. So I stink and haven't looked at any of the accessibility stuff that you did from a year ago, apparently. So I know, I'm a bad person.
No.
Yes, I am, but thank you anyways. So I have a very general question here. Where do you feel the industry currently stands in regards to accessibility?
It always goes back and forth, because every time accessibility just starts to catch up, something new is introduced. I actually, though, think we are in a better spot to make accessible websites than we have been in the past 10 years.
Okay.
Because we're getting rid of a lot of the Flash that had been poisoning sites, because you can't make accessible Flash, I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah.
I got into a, like, almost a bar fight over that. And you can't make accessible Flash, like truly accessible Flash, and everything's moving into like content, and we're doing fewer images. People are using more, like if you look at navigations, they're not images anymore.
Mm-hmm.
5 years ago, that was not the case.
Right.
Everything was like pretty images and stuff. However, we're also moving into some things that are a little tougher. We're getting more web apps that aren't always friendly. We're getting things now, and it's kind of like step back, but then we have Bootstrap, and Bootstrap is super accessible. And if people use Bootstrap, that helps accessibility quite a bit.
Why is that?
It just has a lot of stuff baked in. So, for example, I was at jQuery.conf, and I gave a talk, and I was like, don't use Outline. It's zero or none. I said, if you don't know what Outline does, don't do anything to it. And somebody brought it up, and he's like, why not? And I was like, because then somebody who's using your keyboard to navigate your site can't tell where they are. That's how it shows location. That's what Outline means. And it turns out, and I was so angry about it, and I could not figure out why everybody did this. He's like, that's a part of the default style sheet for some like major thing. And he's like, and everybody pretty much copies and pastes that to start off their CSS.
Oh.
And I was like, are you kidding me? And
he's like, I'll go. So it's just been cargo culted.
Yeah. And he's like, I'll go submit a ticket. And it was roofed. But nobody had realized what it did. And so nobody, like, and I've had arguments with designers that I'm like, take that out. And they're like, well, no. And it's like, it's a part of the default. And I'm like, and I could never understand why they were so just dead set. And I'd ask them, like, what does it do? I don't know. Then maybe you should not style it. You know?
Right.
It's like, so in a way, it's like we're going backwards but forwards. There's some great stuff coming out, like Bootstrap, and people are using it. And then there's, you know, the backwards part. You know, we are getting more web apps, and web apps are a little bit more complicated. You have to use things like Aria. To really understand like how to make a good web application.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have to get better, because the largest population in the United States, like the largest chunk of people right now, are the baby boomers. And they're aging. And as baby boomers age, they enter in to the five categories of accessibility. They lose vision, they lose control over their motor, they lose hearing, they lose cognitive skills, and some of them may even go completely blind. But this is also a generation that is actually computer savvy. Maybe not as savvy as their children, but they have computers, they use them, and they require them. They need them to do things.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of those things where it's like, I think this is going to start forcing it into the forefront, kind of how geriatrics, as the first wave of the baby boomers started to age, geriatrics took off. It was like not a real money, like you didn't get into that, or gerontology. It wasn't something you really got into. Suddenly, that was a field you could get into and make quite a bit of money as a doctor, being somebody who was an expert in aging. Mm-hmm. So I think that the same thing is going to start becoming really true. And also, they have money. You know, that's something I tell people. You know, I told my boss when I came in, my Uber boss, he's like, why should I care about accessibility? And he wasn't being mean. Mm. He was just, you know, he was asking me, and I said, who do you think reads, and I work for Cox Media Group, I'm like, who do you think reads local newspapers? And I was like, do you think it's my generation or your generation? And he's like, I know it's my generation. I've seen the numbers. And I said, well, your generation is losing its eyesight. You know, your generation is going to have to start, is not able to hear videos anymore. Because they have a hearing aid in, but it doesn't quite fill in all the spaces, and they can't put on headphones because of your hearing aid in. It's just, it's real complicated. But I was like, you know, are they going to need their attention spans going down? Mm-hmm. You know, they're having trouble processing information. I was like, we got to fix this. You know, we got to make our websites easy to navigate for somebody who can't use a mouse anymore.
You know, I actually had a question written down to ask you. When someone starts making their site accessible and gets in that mindset, on top of just making the site meeting some accessibility standards, do you find that the overall design of a site changes, and perhaps the mindset of the person designing it?
I find that if you add accessibility, it often increases usability for everybody. So kind of like the rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah.
Now, one of the examples I use, let's say we go with somebody who has ADHD or dyslexia. That there are two groups that have kind of similar needs, so I sometimes lump them even though they're very different groups. If you want to write a group, if you want to have a website that is geared towards people that have these conditions, you would want to do stuff like have highly legible text. Have a white background and black text. Use shorter sentences. Use more paragraph breaks. Use more pictures. Do not use all caps. Do not use blinking. Do not use moving pictures. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds like a fabulous site to me.
No, I was just thinking that. Like, I want to go there right now.
Yeah. It's a great... I'm like, that... It makes better sites. You know, and that... You know, you have to remember that accessibility is not just blind people. And anybody that sits down and takes time to get into the mindset of different people that are using their site automatically starts not forgiving themselves for doing stupid things. So just, I mean, yes, you're getting into the mindset of these very specific individuals, but accessibility is usability.
I like that.
You know, accessibility is usability for a group of users who have additional needs, and not even like completely different. They just have extra needs.
Interesting. Do you know of any like big name sites out there that actually get it wrong in terms of accessibility?
I run into them all the time. Unfortunately,
It's not to pick on anyone here.
No, I don't want to pick on anybody. I was actually doing an accessibility review for Safari Online, and they were messing up some stuff that it was totally not intentional.
Right.
And they're currently trying to fix the stuff, but I was like, if I'm blind, I can't use this site.
Right. Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
Would it be a more positive way to think about it as? Who's getting it right?
Who gets it right?
And
let's see.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so who's doing a really good job? Who should we try to aspire to be rather than who should we like point and laugh at?
Good call.
Let's see. A lot of government, since government, U.S. government sites have to meet a certain accessibility standard, before they can even deploy. Like, we actually had a 508 section that would look, that's government speak for accessible, that would look at the site and tell us that, you have to fix this before we'll move anything, before you can deploy. Pretty much any government site is usually doing it pretty well. I know that it's science.nasa.gov. That's what I worked on at NASA. We worked really closely with the 508 group. We were the group. We didn't kind of view them as annoying. We cared. You know, we really did. And we're like, tell us how to make it better. And so he would go through and he would show us, like, here's how this works. You know, this is why this is bad. This is how you can fix this. So, you know, science.nasa.gov is one that in theory should be good, but I haven't been there for a while, so I don't know. Let's see. I really love Penn State's accessibility site. Oh, they have a great one. Let me look. Penn State accessibility. Like, they have, it's called Accessibility. And if you just look Penn State accessibility, sure. They have a gorgeous site that has everything, and it's also very accessible.
Oh.
So you can go through and find all the things, and, you know, they do it really well. And they're kind of an example of, like, look, your site doesn't need to look, you know, terrible in order to be great.
Are they kind of maybe the poster child for accessibility? Kind of like, what was it? Was it the Boston Globe in terms of responsive design? Would you maybe kind of draw that comparison between the two?
They do it very well. I mean, that's what their site's about. So they have a lot of really great stuff, and a lot of their links go to sites that do it really well.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because one of my other questions was going to be, where would you maybe point someone who is kind of looking for good examples and wants to get into this but currently aren't doing it?
My favorite place is, of course, accessibility. They have it a little bit different at Penn State. That's probably the best place to start because they have links going everywhere and they're constantly updated. And they also go over things like, you know, tools they have, you know, the different groups. There's, of course, my book, Accessibility Handbook. Accessibility Handbook is not what I would consider a here's how to make accessible websites. Like, here's the developer's guide. It is these are the groups. It's a usability guide to understand the tools the groups use. Because if you understand the tools, you suddenly understand the challenges, that it's like, this is what a screen reader does. This is how you get around a website just using your tab key. So.
Okay, gotcha. All right, cool. No, that sounds good, because I may or may not have done a lot of accessibility and maybe want to learn about it.
Yay!
Dave Noyes, are we feeling guilty?
Thanks for calling me out.
It's okay. I feel guilty every time I talk to Katie about this stuff, too.
Okay.
So you've succeeded in that, at least, with me. I apologize that I'm not a better person.
Nice. Do we think it's time for the all-important question?
Well, I do want to ask, because I want to make sure that we kind of wrap up the one thing I wanted to get with the Young Coders tutorial stuff. Where are those materials? Like, where should we look if people want to get out and scale it and remix it and do stuff with it?
They are on GitHub.
Okay.
If you search on GitHub under look for Young Coders.
Okay.
It's under Barbara's. Barbara's actually the one that hosts it, and it's Young Coders tutorial under Mechanical Girl.
Okay.
And do you guys accept...
We'll get that in the show notes for sure, too.
Do you guys take pull requests?
We do. Okay. We absolutely do. We love to see remixes. That's how we've gotten a lot of great stuff. Like, I submitted a sample release for him. The cheat sheet came from my shadow. And we're trying to get more people to remix it into, like, smaller lessons or lessons in different languages.
Great.
So right, awesome. Right now we have 17 forks. Wow. Not cool. Bad.
Sweet.
All right. Hopefully a year from now it'll be like 100.
Yeah.
Or more. So get on it, Python community. All right, Dave.
Excellent.
You've got a question, a burning question that you've been just dying to ask all night, I know.
I've been holding on to a question that is pretty important. What can we do for you to bake us a cake?
To bake you a cake? Oh, you read my thing.
Maybe.
Maybe. Where do you guys live?
Cleveland-ish.
Yeah. I call it upstate Ohio.
I can send cookies.
Ooh. That would be amazing. So, I have confessed to Mike several times. I have a literal addiction to baked goods and things with sugar.
I have, let's see. Oh, I made a lot of cookies this past weekend. I love baking cookies, especially Christmas time. So I made, I think, 6 different kinds of cookies, I think. Ooh. 6 or 7.
What kinds?
I made chocolate crinkles, chocolate chip cookies, Buckeyes.
All those are awesome.
Oh, my gosh. And
Buckeyes are funny because people either go, what are Buckeyes? Or, oh, my God, Buckeyes.
It's, yes.
Yeah, we're in the oh, my God, Buckeyes category, I think. But for listeners who are not familiar with a Buckeye, what is that?
A Buckeye is basically powdered sugar and peanut butter in a ball and covered in chocolate.
And I will never get to have them in my home again.
Why not?
My daughter,
are you for allergies?
My daughter has a nut allergy, and so we cannot do nut stuff. I meant to ask when we were talking about the Young Coders tutorial about the peanut butter and jelly sandwich example. Like,
it's technically almond or cashew butter. Yeah, is what I bring in.
You get cross contamination with all the various nut things, which is goofy.
Yeah, I also warn.
Because like her one reaction that she had was actually not to a peanut, but was to a pecan, which she's not even allergic to. But all the nut stuff gets processed together, and so you get peanuts on everything.
Oh no!
So yeah, I normally surprise.
I warn parents about it, and I'm like, if your children have any serious allergies, you gotta tell us now because we're not medical professionals.
Right.
So we'll work something out. You know, I will make just a jelly sandwich, if need be. And I also keep everything sealed.
Okay,
until
great.
Until all the kids are like, and Barbara was like, what? And I said, you've obviously never worked in a daycare. Like, I worked in a daycare 3 years. You learn, like, the contamination rules that you keep everything sealed until you've confirmed everything, you know, and then you can start opening everything and, like, all that. But yeah, so I think I only make one thing with peanuts in it, but my kitchen is not peanut butter or peanut free, unfortunately.
I will let Dave take the cookies then.
Okay.
And I will live vicariously.
Aw. I'll bring some for you to PyCon.
Oh, that would be so amazing.
I also made potato candy, sugar cookies.
You say potato candy?
Potato candy. Potato candy is a candy that you make out of mashed potatoes, powdered sugar, and you roll it up. And you can use any like center stuff, but I use Nutella. And it's okay. Here's a picture. I found a picture, and I'm gonna put it in chat.
Awesome. Excellent. This is gonna go in the show notes.
Yep. There you go. That's potato candy. And I made oatmeal bars and dream bars. Oh, and I made, just this evening, my daughter and I made cookies for the dogs.
Awesome.
So I have a miniature schnauzer, and so he needed cookies this year.
Nice.
Although I was making the Buckeyes, and some of the dough fell on the floor. And Nate came over, and he's like, dup, dup, you know, and ate it up. And he's like, what is this? And he licked my entire floor clean, trying to find more Buckeye dough.
Oh, yeah.
Manna from heaven.
Oh, he's like, the thing, every time he finds something in the kitchen, it becomes a holy quest to find more of this thing. And he'll like, freak out and like lick everything.
Oh, boy,
my dog is kind of crazy, and he licks whether there's things there or not. This is the reason I have to like be careful about anything I spray on the house. Mm-hmm. Also, he's eaten rocks in the past. Brillo pads. That was a fun one. Oh, yeah, he's fine with that, but if I change his food, instantly sick.
Yeah.
Whatever.
See, Gizmo actually, he's good. He doesn't eat, like, anything he's not supposed to eat. He eats food things. And he normally ignores the kitchen. But if something drops and he finds out it's good...
Oh, yeah.
Because he definitely has an opinion. Like, I accidentally dropped a potato peel while I was peeling the potato for the potato candy. And he went over and licked it and then gave me the most, like, dirty look.
It's like, what are you thinking?
He's like, what am I supposed to do with this? Whatever. He does love French fries, though. So I dropped a French fry earlier at the table, semi on accident.
Yeah,
they are delicious.
They are. And he ate the French fry, and he's like, this is the best thing. Followed me around for an hour watching me. And I'm like, dude, I'm downstairs. The dishes are cleared. I'm not holding anything. I'm not dropping another French fry. That's just not going to happen. You know? He was like, sure, I was going to drop another French fry any moment.
Now that we've been talking about it, do you think you could send us a picture of your recently made cookies?
Absolutely.
I think this would also be a fine addition to these show notes.
Absolutely. I will send me the address for whoever is getting the cookies, and I will get them out. Because I'm also paleo, so I can't... This is my...
Oh, awesome!
This is my bad month, where I'm allowed to eat bad things, but if I eat too many of them, I actually get sick.
Right.
So I have to get them all out of my house. I will set aside, like, one small bag for the person I will meet at PyCon, and that will be safe and stowed away, but everything else has to, like, be out of my house.
See, Dave, now you have to come to PyCon.
Yeah, I know.
You gotta get your passport.
Get right, I'm going to sell a couple organs.
Oh, it won't be that bad. You could do that train trip thing. Have you heard about that?
No.
There's a group that's putting together a charter. I don't know if it's charter necessarily is the right word, but it's a like group rate for a train trip from Toronto to Montreal. So everybody's going to like travel to Toronto, then get on the train and have this mini Python conference on the train on the way to PyCon.
Oh, my goodness.
That's wild.
And I forget the URL for it now. But it's like Python on Rails, I think.
Clever.
Might be. And they make the snakes on a train joke. Yeah. You kind of have to.
Good. Awesome.
Yeah.
Neat.
Is it Python
trivia time?
All right.
I think it's trivia time.
Oh, God.
Okay. So, hopefully these aren't too bad. Last time it was all stuff that completely stumped poor Jesse. He was probably ridiculously tired after talking with us for a couple hours and was kind of taken aback, I think, by Chris's trivia questions. But hopefully these should be a little friendlier. Okay. So, question number one. What Karate Kid veteran stars in Python and Python 2?
By the way, these are real movies. I thought it was like some cutesy trick question. No, these are actual movies.
Wow. I have no idea. I can't even name any of the people in the Karate Kid. Mm. Forever Mr. Miyagi to me.
Right. So this is the young villain.
The young villain?
Yes.
There was a villain?
Yeah.
Oh, that one dude.
The mean bully kid from the Bad Dojo with the
Cobra
legs.
Kai.
Yeah, Cobra Kai.
I was like five when it came out.
All right. William Zabka is his name.
No idea who that is.
Yeah, that didn't help me either. Okay, cool.
For some reason, he's in like the popular culture again because he's been in a couple episodes of How I Met Your Mother this year, which is like weird. And like there's this sudden like... This guy from Karate Kid. Okay. Anyway, all right. So, 0 for 3 here.
No.
Okay, this one may be a little bit better. In 2006, there was an ice cream flavor that was released called Vermonty Python. Who released Vermonty Python?
Oh, that'd be Ben and Jerry's.
That is absolutely correct. Ding, 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 ding. For bonus points, do you know what flavor it was?
Vermonty Python, wasn't that one that was based on, like, maple syrup?
It is a coffee liqueur ice cream.
Really?
With chocolate cookie crumb swirl, and this is my favorite part, fudge cows.
Okay, and actually, I've had that one. I wonder which one I'm thinking of. It's maple syrup.
I don't know.
But
both sound good.
They do, yeah.
I was going to say that.
All right, so yay! We have a winner on that. Okay, and finally, what Monty Python sketch inspired a Python refactoring tool?
Dead parrot.
It is actually
parrot.
Not dead parrot.
Damn!
Do you have a second guess? What if I said it involved two wheels?
Oh, that doesn't help. Oh, my goodness. I have no idea. Tell me.
It is the Bicycle Repairman sketch. Inspired a tool called Bicycle Repairman.
I didn't know what it was.
It is actually a really great sketch. I watched it last night for the first time in probably about 20 years, and it is hilarious. In a world where everyone is Superman, only one man can fix random bicycle problems. He is Bicycle Repairman. So you get to see all the Monty Python people wearing, you know, hanging out at the laundromat, like reading the newspapers and smoking pipes and just, you know, hanging about being Superman in domestic day-to-day life until there's a wrecked bicycle up the lane.
Oh, no!
If only Bicycle Repairman were here.
Oh, so far, I'm...
Awesome. And I'm, like, not even recalling that. That is so bizarre, and I thought I had seen them all.
It's
also, I'm 0 for 6 for trivia.
Well, we have one, so this is a new...
Yay!
Woo-hoo!
New champion!
I feel like this is the early days of 5 questions on The Daily Show, when like no one would get them.
Uh-huh.
But I'm going to be hard-pressed to come up with more, I think. So we'll see how long this feature lasts. All right.
Also, I got to say, you made this interview really easy, Katie.
Aw, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so
much.
Honestly,
this was fun.
I love doing podcasts. If I had more energy, I would do one, like, on my own, but I have no time. That it all gets eaten by children and small animals and stuff, so...
Yeah, I was going to say, I was very impressed that you still managed to find time to blog among all this other stuff going on.
I actually did Nano Blogmo.
Okay.
And NaNoWriMo is National Novel Writing
oh,
Month.
Oh, right, yes.
Where you write, and I'm like, I'm not going to write a novel, but I am going to write 50,000 words of blog posts.
Wow.
Nice. And I did it. And it really, I sold a bunch of them. It was great.
Oh, that's cool.
I have this nice backlog. I had some things that it was kind of like, well, I don't know if I want to write about this. Nobody will care. When you're short on words, you're like, I'll write about anything. And you're just slamming out words. And I was like, cool. And the weird thing is, some things that I had thought on, like the OS divide, I wrote, and I did not think that'd be a controversial post at all. I didn't think anybody would notice it, to be honest. I write most things on my blog, and I'm like, nobody's going to read this. And that one got, like, really weird attention. It was like, some people were, like, you know, tweeting it everywhere, and other people were angry, and it was kind of bizarre. But I got a lot of cool stuff written.
That's
you know?
Great.
It almost kind of feels like it would be like Seinfeld, because you're just writing about anything and everything, and it turns out a lot of it is interesting to people.
I wrote about my oily hair at one point. I have very oily hair, and I was really short on words one day, so I said, here is how I cured my oily hair. And I wrote out this long, like, 1,500-word post going over everything I went through, everything I tried, what worked, what didn't work, the iterations, and what I finally did today that keeps me from having to, like, wash my hair every day and get the really, like, weeping bad scalp. Mm. Oh, and the one I recently wrote, Your Wiki is a Dump.
that one is really good, by the way.
I was just like, I need to write. I hate wikis. I'm going to write about wikis. Like, I'm going to write all this, like, Ben. And it ended up being, you know, a little bit more helpful than I thought it was going to be. I'm like, oh, okay, this actually wasn't, you know, all... I try to end on a good note most times, saying, here's how you can make things better. And I did make sure to post this after my current company put together a team to fix our wiki, because when I came in, it was horrible. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And I had an utter meltdown one day when I was trying to get something to work. And he was like, oh, those instructions don't work anymore. And I was like, why wouldn't they? They've worked, you know, every other time. Oh, they don't work anymore. I put the new instructions over here. I put a notice at the top of the page that said, don't use these, use these. Which, if you're a developer, what do? You scroll down to the part you need. You know, I didn't even look at the top of the page. And I'm like, this page shouldn't exist if it's wrong. He's like, well, what if I need to know a year from now how I did it? And I was like, have you ever needed to know how you did something a year ago? You know, that you now do a different way. And I said, and that's what history is for. I was like, so then we got some better, and I had like a meltdown with my boss that I'm like, I wasted a day trying to figure this out. Because when you're remote, you hate bugging people. Because it's like, oh, they're all busy. I'll figure this out on my own. And you can very easily lose a day.
Yep.
So.
I've done that in the office as well.
Yeah, it's a little easier like in the office. Hey, has anybody ever seen this before? Whereas with the wiki, it's kind of logged and you feel stupid. So.
All right. So it is getting late here for me.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight, Katie.
Definitely.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, seriously, this was fun.
So, therealkatie.net.
Yes.
People should go out and buy the books, read the books.
Yep.
Learn Python, learn accessibility, go remix stuff for young coders.
Cool.
And generally make the world a better place, right?
Yes.
Yay.
Yay.
Right on.
All right. And we will very much look forward to cookie logistics.
Yes. So. Email me all the deets.
Will do.
Awesome.
From Python Import Podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 license, and don't you forget it. Our hosting is made possible by a donation from Rackspace. You can learn more about them at rackspace.com. Our theme music is Code Monkey by Jonathan Colton. To learn more, visit his website at jonathancolton.com. For more random interjections by the non-sequitur monkey, check us out at frompythonimportpodcast.com.
Thanks for listening!
Code Monkey like Fritos. Code Monkey like Tab and Mountain Dew. Code Monkey, very simple man. Big, warm, fuzzy, secret heart. Code Monkey like you. Code Monkey like you.
Whatever.